United States has revealed it was pressing the United Nations not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements within the occupied West Bank. That's despite Washington's calls on its ally to stop expansion in occupied Palestinian territory. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel stated that the United States will oppose any work to update the UN blacklist and has conveyed its concern directly with the Office of the High Commissioner. In February 2020, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights published a list of companies operating in Israeli settlements. The list comprises 112 companies, including Israeli and American ones. The initial publication, which listed U.S. companies including Airbnb, Expedia, and TripAdvisor, was denounced by then-administration of Donald Trump, which had reversed long-standing U.S. opposition to settlements in the West Bank. The statement comes just days after the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that the Biden administration would oppose the Israeli settlement expansion and any bid to annex the West Bank. Since 1967, the Israeli occupation has established more than 230 settlements in the West Bank and Al-Quds, with over 500,000 settlers living in them to date. Despite the UN Security Council condemning the building of settlements, which under international law are all illegal, the Israelis continue expanding the annexation of more Palestinian land until today, with no prospect of stopping in the future. Palestine has slammed the U.S. move to pressure the United Nations not to update its list of companies operating in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki told Voice of Palestine that the Palestinian leadership rejects any U.S. pressure on the UN and its operating institutions. He added that his ministry is working to arrange a meeting with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. His remark came after U.S. State Department announced that Washington continues to oppose any action to update the list and has raised concerns directly with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Emboldened by Washington's all-out support, Israel's illegal settlement activities surged under former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during Trump's administration. The construction activities are in defiance of United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, which pronounced settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds a flagrant violation under international law. In a speech on Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington would judge Benjamin Netanyahu's incoming regime by actions and not personalities. Controversial Israeli politician Netanyahu is likely to return to power after striking a coalition deal with the extreme right outfits, including religious Zionism, which could be put in charge of constructing illegal settlements and the Tel Aviv regime's land grab policies in the occupied Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the international community to criminalize Israeli violations against Palestinians and to hold the occupying regime accountable for its crimes. The movement has stressed that Israeli crimes constitute a flagrant violation of the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the international law, reaffirming its commitment to the legitimate Palestinian rights.
The United States is pressing the UN not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements. The US has said things like it opposes any work to update it, or our view is that this database only serves to reinforce an anti-Israel bias that too often finds traction in UN venues. It also said that this database poses a genuine threat to companies doing business or considering business operations in the region. Yet the U.S. statements lack any concern about how these settlements are illegal in the first place. The UN Human Rights Office published a list back in the year 2020. It was a database of more than 100 companies that it said are doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The database took more than 3 years to complete. It was hailed by campaign groups as a significant step forward in making sure that big business respected international law. The overwhelming majority of the 112 firms named on the database were Israeli, including many of the country's main banks. But the list also included a number of well-known international companies, including, among others, Motorola Solutions, General Mills, TripAdvisor, and Airbnb of the U.S., Apodo and J.C. Bamford of the United Kingdom, and Alstom of France. Israel's largest banks provide services that help support, maintain, and expand unlawful settlements by financing their construction in the occupied West Bank, including partnering with developers to build structures on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. A 41-page report called Bankrolling Abuse, Israeli Banks in West Bank Settlements, detailed the scope of banking activities in settlements and the violations to which these activities contributed. Israel's seven largest banks provided services to the settlements, but funding for illegal settlements took the form of donations, like from the U.S. In the year 2015, an investigation into private U.S. funding of settlements revealed a network of tax-exempt charities that funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to Jewish communities in the West Bank. The money was transferred from New York, Miami, Texas, ending up in Hebron or the Old City of Jerusalem, and all came from organizations for which donations were tax-deductible in the U.S. Israel is already suffering from the BDS movements, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and to pressure Israel to comply with international law. One of the issues that BDS exposes are products that are made in settlements and sold outside of Israel. BDS says the purchase of these products contributes to the Israeli regime and companies operating in occupied Palestinian lands. Israel has built more than 100 settlements in territories it captured from Jordan during a war in 1967. Under international law, the settlements in both the West Bank and Al-Quds, which are home to more than 600,000 people, are considered illegal, although Israel and the U.S. dispute such a characterization. They contribute to a discriminatory regime in which Israeli authorities restrict and stunt Palestinian economic development while subsidizing and supporting Israeli settlements built on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. International humanitarian law forbids an occupying power from using land except for military purposes for the benefit of the local population living under occupation. Even though the U.S. opposes illegal settlements, its actions by all means support Israel and falls way short of taking any action to stop it. And now, with an extreme far-right administration that the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is forming, settlement building may move at an accelerated pace.
For me, the results of the last elections from last week is no less than a revolution in the national sense and in my personal life, because I've been yearning for a moment when the powers that are for the great Israel and for Jewish values, that these political powers will be in government.
The new Israeli administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, have agreed to legalize settlements. They announced that they will move ahead and amend what's called the disengagement law in order to enable settlers to settle in the northern occupied West Bank. It would legalize dozens of illegal West Bank outposts, something known as young settlements. All of this spells bad news for Palestinians who are fighting for their land.
President Xi hails a new era of relationships with the Persian Gulf state during his meeting with King Salman in his three-day stay at Yamama Palace in Saudi Arabia. The world's largest exporter of crude oil, joined by the world's largest importer of it, signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement that involved the Chinese tech giant Huawei. Huawei is one of the companies that just recently was barred from exporting its equipment to the U.S. because of a recent imports ban in the U.S. on certain high-profile Chinese tech firms, including the likes of ZTE and Hikvision. While this was the most restrictive ban, it is not an isolated ruling. Anti-Chinese rhetoric became mainstream during Donald Trump's residency when he banned all of Huawei's 5G equipment from the U.S. and even by extension in some EU countries. He also banned U.S. citizens from owning Xiaomi stocks, labeling the company as a communist Chinese military company. Despite the U.S. security officials warning that equipment from Chinese brands such as Huawei in the field of telecommunications can be used to collect sensitive information, most of the 5G infrastructure in the Persian Gulf states is built, at least with the partial assistance from Huawei. With all the hassle that the U.S. has been causing these Chinese businesses, it was only a matter of time before they looked elsewhere to grow their business, as relationships between the U.S. and China are shaky at best. Now Saudi Arabia has become an important destination to grow these brands. But on the other side, Saudi Arabia's relationships with the U.S. is also at a low point, and King Salman's meeting with Xi Jinping solidifies the signal that was already being sent that Saudi Arabia is inching away from the U.S. This is becoming more and more apparent over the disagreements between the two countries over energy policies, security guarantees, and human rights issues. The U.S. isn't making inflammatory comments about the visit, but the coordinator for strategic communications of U.S. National Security Council, John Kirby, did say that, quote, "We're mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world." Saudi Arabia's energy minister said that the relationship between the two countries is witnessing an epoch-making milestone, as he vowed that the kingdom will remain China's credible and reliable partner when it comes to oil production. Saudi Arabia isn't the only country warming up to China and even Russia, as the OPEC Plus decision to cut down on oil production amid rising demands from the West and especially the U.S. was a joint decision between the kingdom and Russia as the leaders of the major oil exporting organization. While Saudi Arabia sees the U.S. as its top security partner, the recent shakeup in their relationships, especially as a result of that very same OPEC Plus decision, has prompted the oil-rich kingdom to diversify on its partners list. It has shown that it does not want to hurt its relationship with Russia, as they have significant shared interests as leaders of the most influential crude oil exporting organization, and now it is showing that it is not shying away from cozying up to the U.S.'s trade war rival, China. As the use of Chinese yuan in the China-Saudi oil settlements is becoming increasingly more likely, especially during President Xi's visit to the kingdom, there is also the possibility of Saudi Arabia joining BRICS, as interest has been shown by the kingdom to join the trade-centered organization that also includes Russia as a member state. If, in fact, Saudi Arabia agrees to receive the Chinese yuan in exchange for its oil, that will be considered a massive blow to the falling hegemony of the U.S. dollar in world trade, and especially in oil. This de-dollarization effort has been accelerating, and the first major instance of it happened as Western sanctions first started pouring in on Russia to limit its trade potential. What ended up happening was that as China's oil imports from Russia went up, state-owned oil enterprises increasingly used the Chinese yuan as payments. While all European Union member states are one way or another forced to cooperate with the U.S. in sanctioning Russia, even if at an extremely high cost, the rest of the world is seeing less and less of an obligation to bend down to the will of the once hegemonic superpower as they see the prospect of a multipolar world more and more plausible and desirable.
A group of Australian lawmakers arrived in Taiwan despite warnings from Beijing over the visit at a time of rising tensions over the self-ruled island.
There's a group of bipartisan members of the parliament from Australia currently visiting Taiwan. They are already here. We appreciate that the Australian parliament is very friendly to Taiwan.
Taipei's foreign ministry stated that the members of the delegation will meet the territory's president and other officials during their five-day visit. The ministry added the meetings will focus on a wide array of issues of mutual interest. The Chinese foreign ministry expressed opposition to the trip, calling on Canberra to respect the One China principle.
Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. The One China policy is a recognized norm of international relations, and it is also the prerequisite and political basis for China to develop friendly relations with other countries. The Australian side should earnestly abide by the One China policy, stop any form of official exchanges with the Taiwan region.
Under the One China policy, Beijing considers Taiwan a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland. The spokesperson also warned Australia against official exchanges with Taiwan, calling on Canberra to stop sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan. The visit to Taiwan comes as Australia's recently elected Labour government has moved to repair its strained diplomatic relations with China. Last month, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. But the parliamentary trip to Taiwan would cast a shadow on attempts to build ties between Beijing and Canberra. Albanese sought to play down the mission's significance after it was first reported. He insisted the visit was separate from government business, saying there have been backbench visits to Taiwan for a long time. Australia had long maintained it didn't have to choose between China and the U.S., but in recent years, its attitude toward Beijing has revealed where it stands in the world. Signing the AUKUS Security Pact with the U.S. and U.K. and rotational presence of American forces in Australia are a testament to Canberra taking the side of the U.S. over China. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will increase the rotational presence of its forces in Australia.
Today, we agreed to deepen our defense cooperation in several important ways, including enhancing our force posture cooperation. And based upon today's talks, we will increase rotational presence of U.S. forces in Australia. That includes rotations of bomber task forces, fighters, and future rotations of U.S. Navy and U.S. Army capabilities.
The United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan.
What we want is a region that is stable, prosperous, and respectful of sovereignty. And as we've made clear many times, U.S. engagement in the Indo-Pacific makes an indispensable contribution to such a region.
The two allies made the announcement following annual high-level talks between the top U.S. and Australian defense and diplomatic officials. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Washington sees Canberra as a vital partner in its effort to push back against China in the Indo-Pacific, and analysts say Australia could have a crucial logistical role to play in the defense of Taiwan against any move by Beijing. Australia's Northern Territory is already host to frequent military collaborations with the United States. Thousands of U.S. Marines rotate through the territory annually for training and joint exercises, started under former President Barack Obama. The United States is also planning to deploy up to 6 nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to an airbase in northern Australia, amid heightened tensions with China. Canberra has moved to bolster relations in the Pacific amid growing Chinese influence, including a security pact between China and Solomon Islands in April. In September, the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia marked the one-year anniversary of the AUKUS Security Pact. They then announced that they have made significant progress towards Australia acquiring nuclear-powered submarines.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a recount in Massachusetts has flipped the state house election to Democrat by just a single vote. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. We'll The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and gives us more details. A recount in a political race in Massachusetts has flipped a state House of Representatives election from Republican to Democrat by just a single vote. Democrat Christine Kastner won against her Republican opponent and five-term incumbent Lenny Mira earlier this week after a recount that shrunk the candidate's narrow vote deficit to just one. The candidates were all vying for a seat based in the North Shore area, which is a coastal region between Boston and New Hampshire. Prior to the recount, Lenny Mira led Christine Kastner by just 10 votes out of over 23,000 ballots that were cast in that region during the 8th of November midterm election. The 10-vote deficit was within the legal threshold for a recount. On 30th of November, Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin ordered hand recounts in a general area where Lenny Mira held a slim advantage. After officials recounted the votes in question on Thursday, the results emerged as 11,763 to 11,762. Christine Kastner was ahead by the slightest of margins. In response to that outcome, Lenny Mira said that he will absolutely challenge the result, the Boston Globe reported. Some ballots were filled out in pencil, some were filled out with different colored ink, some had stray marks. Some had a name written in the write-in and then an oval filled out, the outlet reported him saying. Meanwhile, Christine Kastner believes that there was no foul play in the voting process, saying, "I feel the process unfolded like it should. We'll see what comes when it comes," the Boston Globe reported. "We're not suspicious of anything that ever happened. The recount was just to ensure that between humans and machines, we really caught every vote and that was counted," Christine Kastner told CBS. "We thank the tremendous outpouring of people that really got involved and mobilized to go through this process this weekend. It's really a true test of democracy." The new results will go to Governor Charlie Baker for a gubernatorial council for review. Should the recount go unchanged, Democrats will hold 133 of the 160 House districts come next January, again in four more seats compared to what they started the last session with at the beginning of 2021. In 2020, Massachusetts offered temporary mail-in voting for the first time as a result of the coronavirus pandemic precautions. Earlier this year, lawmakers voted to make permanent mail-in voting and expanded early voting, two measures which Lenny Mira and the rest of the Republican House caucus voted against. The measures were nevertheless signed into law by Governor Charlie Baker this summer. CBS News has also covered the same story, giving us more details. Democrat Christine Kastner jumped into the lead over five-term Republican Representative Lenny Mira after a district-wide recount erased her narrow deficit and put her ahead by just a single vote, an infinitesimally tight outcome that the incumbent plans to challenge in a court of law. Lenny Mira led Christine Kastner by just 10 votes out of more than 23,000 cast across the North Shore district in the original certified results for the November 8 midterm election, a margin well within the legal threshold that allowed her to file for a recount. By the time Topsfield officials finished retabulating ballots on Thursday from their town's first precinct, the final batch to be counted, the overall result flipped and put Christine Kastner up 11,763 to Lenny Mira's 11,762. Lenny Mira said he plans to challenge the outcome, which would further extend a month-long stretch of uncertainty about who will be the next representative for the redrawn North Shore District of Massachusetts. It will be absolutely a legal challenge, Lenny Mira said. Five voters picked other candidates in the race between Kastner and Mira, and 638 left that field blank on their ballots, Secretary of State William Galvin's office said. Christine Kastner picked up 10 votes in Ipswich, 4 votes in Rowley, 3 votes in Topsfield, a net single vote in Newbury, and just 1 vote in Georgetown, according to data provided by Galvin's office. Lenny Mira added a net 5 votes in Ipswich, 3 votes in Topsfield, and 1 in Newbury, while losing a vote in Rowley. "We are not suspicious of anything that ever happened. The recount was just to ensure that between humans and machines, we really caught every vote that was counted," Christine Kastner, a Hamilton resident who previously worked as planning director for the town of Burlington, said. She added, "We thank the tremendous outpouring of people that really got involved and mobilized to go through this process this weekend. It's really a true test of democracy. If the result holds, it would reflect another blow for Republicans who lost every Massachusetts statewide race, including the coroner office, and expand the gains Democrats made to their legislative supermajority this cycle." The updated results will now go to Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker and the Governor's Council, which does not plan to meet again until Wednesday for recertification. Lenny Mira, a Georgetown Republican, said attorneys for both sides challenged or questioned several dozen votes during the recount. Only ballots protested at a time during a recount can then be challenged in a court of law. Yesterday in Rowley, they were able to use 5 spoiled ballots that all went to my opponent. In no other town did they let us use spoiled ballots, he said, adding that there were several other mail-in votes in Ipswich for which he believes signatures do not match their envelopes. A battle in a court of law over the validity of individual ballots could thrust the state's voting reforms into the spotlight. Massachusetts rolled out widespread mail-in voting for the first time in 2020, albeit on a temporary basis, in an attempt to ensure that ballot processes, while minimizing the risk of COVID-19 transmission at polling stations. Lawmakers then moved this summer to make that option, as well as expanded early voting, permanent features.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, following the prophets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that the Quran is the book of guidance, and Allah has sent the book of guidance in the shape of Quran, and He has mentioned the stories of the prophets. And these stories are for the guidance of the mankind. If someone wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must follow the guidance that is being given by the Quran. Therefore, when we look at the life of the prophets, in order to get some guidance from there, for example, in the life of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, we see that the Prophet Musa alayhi salam was the one who stood against the oppression of his time. Bani Israel, who was under the pressure and the oppression of the Pharaoh, and they couldn't go anywhere where the Pharaoh was killing their kids. He was killing the generations. He had them under the oppression. He came as a Messiah and he saved them. He was the savior of the Bani Israel of that time. And therefore, it shows us that if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, we cannot live by closing our lips and not talking not talking against the oppression. If we are silent, we are not raising our voice against the oppression, then obviously the same thing that has happened to Bani Israel at the time of Pharaoh will happen to us. And this can only be done in order to have a good lifestyle. It can only be done if we follow the footsteps of Prophet Moses alayhi salam, the way he raised his voice against the oppression, the way he came in front of the Pharaoh. And today even we see that the oppression that is going around the world, how the oppression is happening. And those who are silent, they are having more oppression. But those who raise their voice, they are living a free life. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of following prophets in the Islamic lifestyle. We gave the example of the Prophet Moses alayhi salam, how he stood against the oppression and how he was acknowledged, or he knew about the time where he was living, about the things that were happening in his time. And we see that Prophet Moses, with all knowledge, has come against the oppression. And that is the duty of every single Muslim. If they want to have the Islamic lifestyle, they must be aware of what is happening around the world, the oppression that is happening. For example, we can see people in Yemen, we can see oppression in Yemen, in Palestine, we can see oppression in the West or East. There is many discriminations that are happening, many things that are against the Islamic teachings. We can see, for example, you know, the movement of LGBT. This is against the beliefs that we have. This is against the beliefs that the Prophet Moses had. Obviously, Prophet Lut was at the time of the Prophet Moses, and they were living at the same time. So the prophets in the Quran, they stood against these types of theories or thoughts. Why? Because these things are not taking us towards the perfection. The goal is to go towards the fitrah. The goal is to reach to the perfection. And the only place, only time when we can reach to perfection, or we can travel towards the perfection, is when we are aware of everything, what is right and what is wrong. And we are raising our voice against the wrong things. We should not be amongst the wrongdoers. If today the world, the secular world, or the world who is against even God, if they are having the movements against the teachings of the religion, against the teachings of Allah, for example, in the shape of LGBT movement, I don't know, in the shape of feminism, in any shape, if they are a Muslim, if he wants to have an Islamic lifestyle, he must aware his kids of these frauds, these things that are happening, these wrong, we can say, beliefs, and we need to save our children, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces continue their attacks against Palestinians. What is disappointing is the inaction from world community and the so-called defenders of human rights. In this regard, we have provided views from world media websites. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada had this headline, writing, "Why are Israel's cops a strategic partner for EU?" This website noted, "Supporters of the Israeli regime, believe it or not, get one or two things right. The constant claim that their beloved regime cherishes innovation contains a grain of truth. What other oppressive views Facebook and Twitter as such vital tools for alerting the world to its brutality?" On October 8, the Zionist regime police force effectively admitted that it was subjugating civilians en masse. The force posted photographs on the internet of its officers helping to seal off Shafat refugee camp near Al-Quds. The Zionist regime presented the suffocation of Shafat as a response to the killing of an Israeli troop. Collective punishment is forbidden under the Geneva Conventions and other instruments of international law. Every time it resorts to collective punishment, the Zionist regime commits a war crime. Avoiding democratic oversight, the European Union has built a formal alliance with the Zionist regime's police. The EU even signed an accord on deepening ties with Israeli regime's police during September, just a few weeks before that force implicitly boasted of committing a war crime in Shafat camp. Though that accord, the Zionist regime can exchange personal data about Palestinians living under occupation with Europol, the EU's police agency. The deal was put together quite swiftly by EU standards. Negotiations aimed at sealing it kicked off in November 2021. Around the same time that the talks opened, the Israeli regime sent a delegation of 30 high-ranking diplomats to Brussels. Among the many officials they met were Laurent Michel from the Migration and Home Affairs Department of the European Commission, the EU's executive. A briefing note prepared for Michel's discussions obtained under Freedom of Information rules states that Israel is a strategic partner country for the EU on security cooperation. The accord signed in September this year follows on from a 2018 working arrangement between the Israeli regime and Europol. The briefing note for Mashal contends that there should be even stronger cooperation with the Zionist regime. It points out that Europol assists the national authorities of EU governments in identifying cross-border links to organized crime. The Israeli contribution in such cases continues to be of utmost importance, it adds. Since the 2018 arrangement entered into force, the Israeli regime has established a liaison office at Europol's headquarters in The Hague. Such steps offer considerable potential to promote operational contribution, the briefing note says. The 2018 arrangement gives a list of crimes on which the Zionist regime and Europol may work together. They include terrorism and war crimes. It stipulates, too, that information exchanged between the two sides must not be collected in obvious violation of human rights. Joke? Was that somebody's idea of a joke? The Zionist regime's police force, as already noted, actively commits war crimes while serving a state that labels all forms of resistance to its systematic violence as terrorism. The Zionist regime systematically uses torture against Palestinians in so-called terrorism investigations, methods which are officially sanctioned and carried out with impunity. The fact that the Zionist regime's police force is based in occupied East Al-Quds should be sufficient to rule out any dealing with it. Despite opposing the Zionist regime's colonization of East Al-Quds on paper, the EU has embraced a police force which plays an integral part in colonization. And what does obvious violation of human rights mean in this context? Does the EU seriously want the Israeli regime to be a little more subtle in the way it subjugates Palestinians? The Zionist regime's police force is not the only despicable body to enjoy a metaphoric message from EU representatives lately. The EU's embassy in Tel Aviv has just teamed up, and not for the first time, with the European Leadership Network, perhaps the most deceptively named outfit in the Zionist regime's army of professional lobbyists. Both the embassy and the European Leadership Network recently hosted a conference for experienced diplomats, officials, and experts. Among the few details published about the event were that it discussed Russia's tension with Ukraine. It is a safe thing that the participants were too polite to denounce the Israeli regime's aggression against Palestinians. Senior figures in the European Leadership Network have raised funds to support that aggression. At one point, the group even counted Michael Herzog, now the Zionist regime's ambassador to the U.S., among its management. He had a significant role in planning a 2002 bombing raid on Gaza, in which 8 children were killed. Don't expect the EU to shun the butchers of Palestinian children. The fabricated regime of Israel, after all, is a strategic partner for the EU.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of arrogant powers, policies, and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. Optimizing of all aspects of the armed forces, including military equipment, weapons, and even ammunition, is one of the important issues that needs to be addressed. The same applies to research and scientific advances, which also play an important role in strengthening the armed forces, as does designing complex hybrid war plans. The wars that are going on in the world today use hybrid warfare. You know, hard warfare, soft warfare, intellectual warfare, cultural warfare, war using various weapons, cognitive warfare, and the like. These are all combined together to attack a nation or a country. By the will of God, war games should be able to take care of all these layers with new, up-to-date methods. So, what is the primary responsibility of the armed forces? It is the protection of national security. This is what you, young people, who have just come onto this path, need to be proud of. The armed forces are responsible for the general security of the country. What is the meaning of security? Security is the foundation for all aspects of life in a society. It is a general foundation for personal issues, social issues, public issues, and foreign matters. Security is the foundation of all these things. With regard to personal matters, having security means you can sleep safely in the comfort of your own home during the night.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You can send your children to school in the morning without having to worry. You can commute to your workplace. And you can attend Friday prayers without having to worry about anything. Just look at the countries that worry about these things. They can neither sleep well during the night, nor can they go to work during the day. They cannot freely watch a sporting match, nor can they attend Friday prayers or go on a vacation. And this does not just apply to smaller countries. In big countries, the US being the worst, there is no security in their restaurants. There is no security in their universities. There is no security in the schools that their children attend.
Allah, I want to thank you. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Another attempt to stoke division in Iran by terrorists who would stop at nothing to reach their goal of creating instability. On December 9th, officials in Sistan and Balochistan province said the body of slain Sunni cleric Molevi Abdulwahid Righi, who was kidnapped a day earlier, has been found. According to police reports, on Thursday, a number of unknown individuals took him away in a car that had no license plate.
He was a good person who always tried to help people. He was my student. He always supported the Islamic Republic.
He was a patriotic and religious person. Iran's unity and territorial integrity was very important to him, and he even served in the Iran-Iraq War.
Days before he was kidnapped, he met a delegation representing leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the province. Molevi Abdulwahid Righi always emphasized on the importance of allegiance to the Islamic Republic. In the province, he was seen as a symbol of unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Sistan and Balochistan province is among the regions most affected by the recent farm-backed riots in the country. And this recent assassination is an obvious attempt to stoke division. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Every product showcased carries one same tag, made in Iran, which is also the title of this exhibition. It's the 10th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products in a range of industries, from oil and petrochemical sectors to electricity, agriculture, and health.
Quadcopter. To look for example, people or survivor under the rubble, so also we can save them.
We have showcased our 3D printer today. 3D printing can manufacture parts within hours, which speeds up the prototyping process. This allows for each stage to complete faster.
I work in Saadi Foundation. We are trying to develop a Persian language through softwares, and we're trying to make people know about Iran, the truth about Iran.
The expo is a hot marketplace for local tech products, as it gives a chance to manufacturers to trade their products here. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount, funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production.
Our equipment are considered inventions, so they are not well known. Now, this expo shines a light on our products and has so far helped us find many customers.
Since the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the Iranian government still pursues diplomatic channels with the West, it capitalizes more on domestic production, as it believes this will shield the economy against foreign pressures.
Local brands here say the United States measures have given domestic production a boost in Iran. As they say, the government has made a strategic shift toward an economy that's driven by made-in-Iran products.
Yusuf Jalali, Press TV, Tehran.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders in many cases have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights on the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they are not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observed the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended morning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The morning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless, and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women, but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household